Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Opera News. My name is Keith. The following articles are from the March 2024 Opera with Opera News magazine, and we'll begin by continuing Opera in the USA, Chicago. Joy Hermelin, for example, in the non-singing cameo role of the Duchess of Krakentorp, larded shrill French patter with unfunny English asides, while Ronita Miller compromised a hearty vocal performance by playing the Marquise de Birkenfeld as a snobbish, humorless battle axe. The character is melting into loving motherhood at the final curtain came out of nowhere. Thank goodness, then, for the veteran Alessandro Corbelli, who exuded buffo bonhomie as Sulpice. The conductor Speranza Scappucci maintained a felicitous balance between comedy and pathos in an auspicious house debut, presenting the score with the spirited affection and light touch that certified her credentials as a bel canto stylist. The orchestra responded to her ministrations crisply and alertly, while the chorus threw themselves gamely into their varied duties as soft-hearted soldiers and happy, peppy peasants. By rights, the nose should have reached Chicago long ago, but it fell to the city's foremost producer of new and off-the-grid opera, Chicago Opera Theater, to present the first local staging of the young Shostakovich's wildly absurdist farce, based on a short story by Gogol. The exuberant new production by the director Francesca Zambello, seen on December 8th at the Harris Theater for Music and Dance, and given as part of the company's 50th anniversary season, served the best interests of an unwieldy opera that has only gradually gained traction in the West. The South African visual artist William Kentridge's 2010 staging at the Metropolitan Opera, revived in 2013, marked a major upturn in its fortunes on these shores. The two performances represented the swan song of Lydia Yankovskaya, who is stepping down as music director at the end of the current season after an enterprising and generally successful 7-year tenure that introduced a number of her Slavonic specialties to the local repertory, including neglected stage works by Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff, and Szymanowski. Shostakovich's brashly experimental opus made the composer, then in his early 20s, an avatar of the Soviet avant-garde, but only briefly. The opera was savaged by proletarian critics and precipitously dropped from the repertory not long after its 1930 premiere in Leningrad, not to be revived in the West until the 1960s and in the Soviet Union in 1974. When it was seen in a production supervised by the composer. The episodic narrative concerns a petty bureaucrat named Kovolyov, who wakes one morning to discover his nose is missing, possibly the victim of an unkind cut by his barber. As he tears through St. Petersburg in frantic pursuit of his detached organ, which meanwhile has swelled to human size and taken on a life of its own, he encounters a raft of characters that flesh out a raucous satire on self-important bureaucrats. Shostakovich's clamorous score consists of angular vocal lines juxtaposed with parody galops, polkas, marches, and the like, done up in vivid orchestral colors and quirky instrumentation, including an extended interlude for percussion. Those of us who found Kentridge's Met realization relentlessly busy, cluttered with far too much visual imagery, could only breathe a sigh of relief after the relative restraint of Zambello's production. Simply keeping the many moving parts working in sync is challenge enough for any stage director, but she appreciated the fact that sledgehammer satire of this sort works best when played relatively straight. Working within the abstract whimsy of Marcus Doshi's unit set, essentially a series of retractable panels connected by inclined ramps, and Eric Teague's witty costumes, Curtis Bannister in the title role had a huge plaster nose protruding from his abdomen. She kept the show moving in lockstep with the unflagging energy of Yankovskaya's incisive, deftly paced conducting. The orchestra grappled successfully with the rigors of Shostakovich's unfamiliar opus, punctuating the onstage zaniness with perfectly timed musical horse laughs. Bravo to each and every player, and of course to Yankovskaya. The Russian-American conductor has given Chicago nothing finer during her 7 years in the job. How a company that has weathered many lean years during its half-century, as the operatic David to lyric opera's Goliath, could muster a budget big enough to fill the opera's 91 named roles, many of them double and even triple cast, was beyond me. But the huge ensemble of local and national singers acquitted themselves with distinction, generally speaking. Not surprisingly, the Ukrainian-American baritone Alexei Bogdanov had the best Russian diction of anyone, and he inhabited the beleaguered Kovalyov with absolute conviction and a most winning vocal and dramatic presence. None of the other 10 principal singers had much to sing, and a few tenors were audibly strained by the high tessitura of their roles. Even so, several singers among the supporting multitudes rose to distinction, notably David Kangalosi as the anti-hero's solicitous lackey, Ivan, Samuel Weiser as the newspaper clerk, Doctor, and Quinn Middleman in Boya Waye as the status-seeking Countess Potocina and her daughter. 6 splendid young dancers from the South Chicago Dance Theater served the important function of sustaining visual continuity and toting props during the interludes and other scenes. Zambello inserted a clever touch at the end, when she had the nose, by virtue of its newfound rank in the government hierarchy, winning over the ladies, thereby underscoring Gogol's point that the privileged classes enjoy the upper hand in practically any society. By John von Rhein. New Orleans. For its season opener on September 29th, the New Orleans Opera chose La Nozze di Figaro, last heard here in 2015. The precisely played overture, conducted by Elizabeth Askren, began an evening at the Mahalia Jackson Theater for the Performing Arts, in which Mozart's score never threatened to lose one's attention. In addition to artistic ability, a well-balanced cast of principals brought youthful vigor and believable characterization to their roles. Anthony Reed, Figaro, impressed both with mastery of his delivery and clear enunciation of the text, while Katie J. Bryan, a charming Susanna, scored throughout and especially with a lovely De Viene Non Todar. Theo Hoffman and Lakita Mitchell, Count and Countess Almaviva, met the challenges of their respective roles, he in full command of Vedro Mentrio Sospiro, while the soprano, once past some tuning problems earlier in the evening, was on firm ground with Dove Sono, well acted and beautifully sung. Sun Lee Pierce was the feisty and charming Cherubino, a delightful portrayal. In supporting roles, it was a pleasure to welcome back Ashraf Sawalem Bartolo, following his local debut the previous season as Rossini's version of the crafty doctor, while Margaret Gauriasak, Marcellina, Ivan Griffin, Antonio, Joel Dyson, Barbarina, and Tyrone Chambers II, Basilio, held their own. The production, designed by Stephen C. Kemp, was light and airy, and allowed for quick scene changes with only a single intermission. The director, Chaz Robert Schieber, using chorus members in livery, kept the action flowing as sets were changed. Having opened with an 18th-century masterpiece, the company then presented the first Southern performance, November 10th, of a work that had its premiere at Glimmerglass in 2019, Janine Tesori's Blue. The libretto, by Tazewell Thompson, focuses on an African-American family and the tragic loss of an only son, whose death by gunfire during a peaceful street protest raises questions about family relationships, justice, and consolation. While the all-black cast was uniformly impressive, the most powerful vocal and dramatic performance was delivered by Corey McGee, the father, whose confrontation with his son while trying to impress upon the young man his concern, his love and support, won him an ovation. Christy Swan, the mother, was determined to bear and raise a son, even in a society laden with fears and challenges. Her three girlfriends, played by Shabrell D. Williams, Courtney J. Holmes, and Kendra Faith Beasley, initially expressed misgivings while ultimately providing their support. In the early scenes, Jonathan Pierce Rhodes captured the adolescent restlessness and generational alienation of the son and met the vocal demands later in the score. Gordon Hawkins, the Reverend, added weight with his support of the father in crisis and then during the impressive choral funeral service. Supporting roles were well handled, the direction by Timothy Douglas was clear throughout, and the scenic designs by Tony Sizek made for a fluid picture. The orchestra, conducted by Michael Ellis Ingram, played Tesori's attractive score with clarity. The company's pre-opening night indication that they would provide emotional support if needed may have unwittingly frightened off some potential ticket purchasers, those not familiar with the opera's story or Tesori's music, and an audience generally not enthusiastic about modern scores that stray too far from the standard repertory also affected turnout. But while Blue was not as well attended as it merited, those who came were engrossed by both its theme and its music and remained to cheer all the participants. By Jack Belsom. New York. There were two items of special interest in the Metropolitan Opera's new Carmen production, which opened on New Year's Eve and was seen by me at the second performance, January 3rd. The first was the house debut of Cary Cracknell as stage director. The second was the first Met performance in a major role, following her Met debut as Madalena in 2022, of Aigul Akhmetshina as Carmen. Cracknell stumbled, Akhmetshina shone. Cracknell has done well-received work in theater and film in Britain, but while her production of Wozzeck at ENO was reportedly successful, she was otherwise inexperienced in opera when Peter Gelb hired her for this Carmen. In numerous interviews, her main ideas were to boost the agency of women by making Carmen a stronger character and Don Jose a weak, abusive male, and to update the action to the American Rust Belt in the mid-southern border. Escamillo became a bull rider. There are ample cowboy hats and guns and trucks in Act Two, supposedly barreling down a road with wheels spinning, but with no illusion of speed. The spirit of the musicologist Susan McClary hovers, with her complaints about the abuse of women in 19th-century opera. But Cracknell doesn't articulate this very persuasively. Carmen has plenty of agency in the original, and her murder is staged much as it usually is, although José kills her from behind with one swing of a baseball bat, a shocking image. There are vague hints of racism, too. Carmen is a gypsy, which may make her murder a matter of indifference to white America. Akhmetshina, while raised in Russia, is half Tatar, half Bashkir. Other updates include Carmen's compadres smuggling guns. Men are supposedly out of work and hence emasculated, though most of those we see are employed soldiers. Sometimes titles and even sung text are updated to match these concepts. Sometimes not. As usual with the Met's huge stage, choristers and extras clutter the action. If Cracknell was trying to make points about illegal immigration, it is not clear. The usually estimable Michael Levine did the ugly sets, which revolve incessantly and are backed by glaring neon strips, mostly white, sometimes red. Instead of a bullfighting parade at the beginning of Act 4, we have rodeo clowns and kids on skateboards. A shadowy woman leads off each act, her hand pressed against the scrim as if to escape the patriarchy. But that doesn't correspond to Carmen's character in the opera. One could go on. It's a mess. Musically, this first cast, there's a new one for April and May, was a different story. Vocally, Achmet Sheena was terrific, with a rich mezzo and a shining top. There was a little edge to her voice at the beginning, but it smoothed out quickly. And dramatically, too, she excelled. She was plenty seductive, and her agility, clambering around the set pieces, was impressive. Carmen is her signature role. Though still only 27, she has starred in 7 productions of the opera already, with 2 more coming up at Covent Garden and Glyndebourne. Gelb, always on the lookout for box office stars to replace the banished Anna Netrebko, has now signed up Achmet Sheena for multiple roles into the foreseeable future. Piotr Beksawa fell ill and was out for at least the first 2 performances. But his replacement as José, Rafael Davila, held up his end, vocally stentorian and apparently more secure in the stage action at the second performance than when he was rushed on at short notice for the opening night. Kyle Kettleson, who appeared as Escamillo often in Richard Eyre's admired 2009 Met production, repeated that role. He sang stoutly, though without much sexiness or bravado. Angel Blue made a lovely Michaela, with Wei Wu, Zuniga, Sidney Mancasola, Frasquita, and Brianna Hunter, Mercedes, strong in lesser roles. The Met chorus was, as usual, excellent, although here maybe their large numbers helped. The conductor, Daniel Rustioni, was criticized in some initial reviews for blandness after a snappy Act 1 prelude. On January 3rd, he propelled the entire score bracingly, with brisk but not excessively fast tempos and vigorous accents. Julie Taymor's Magic Flute in English has been supplanted at the Met by Simon McBurney's staging in German, conceptually clever though perhaps overstuffed with good ideas. But Taymor's visually dazzling version lives on in truncated form as a family-friendly holiday show. At 100 intermission-less minutes, it might seem unfriendly for children and disappointing for those adults who know the complete opera. But Taymor's props and costumes have a Lion King-like appeal for youngsters, and maybe a shorter flute also attracts adult neophytes. The December 15th evening performance, matinees naturally draw more children, looked pretty full. The Taymor production has been reviewed many times in whatever form. Its December 15th outing was of interest because it marked the advent of an almost entirely new cast. The holdover was the redoubtable Catherine Lewick, who lives close to New York and has been singing the Met's Queen of the Night in whatever language forever, plus all over the world. She's the role's leading exponent. At this performance, she belted out the coloratura with her typical flair, even if some of the passage work sounded a bit slurred. Otherwise, the cast was all new and mostly all good. Joshua Blue made a manly Tomino, with Liv Redpath a sweet if slightly bland Pomina. Alexander Birch Elliott was not the funniest Papageno within memory, but he did the job for a part that's hard to keep fresh. James Creswell was the sonorous Sarastro, with solid low notes. William Guanbosu, a serviceable speaker, and Thomas Campobianco, a lively monostatos. Daniel O'Hearn and Matthew Ankle sang the 2 armored men, guards in the cast list, strongly, though again one regretted the absence of their beautiful chorale leading off the trials. Lindsay Oz was the rambunctious Papagena. The trios of ladies and boys, spirits, sang Shirley. And Gareth Morrill, a Met staff conductor, shaped an idiomatic performance by John Rockwell. And now opera on DVD and Blu-ray, disc of the month. Die Meistersinger von Nürnberg, Wagner. Naxos DVD 2.110766-67. Blu-ray NBD0172-79V. 281 minutes. The vital ingredient in any staging of Die Meistersinger von Nürnberg has to be its sense of community. In setting Wagner's comedy entirely within a musty, wood-paneled music school, the Deutsche Oper's 2022 production creates a plausible world, built around an academic guild keen to enthuse the locals with ideals of holy German art, but foiled by the pony-tailed playboy Walter von Stolzing, Klaus Florian Voigt, in cahoots with the celebrity poet Hans Sachs, Johann Reuter. Reuter's barefoot Sachs is no cobbler, but a Jack Daniels addict, providing calisthenic services and fit sticks to a clientele crippled by hideous footwear. Only the aristocratic Walter sports real leather shoes. This may not sound promising. Yet though not everything comes off, we're treated to a satisfying evening of genuine comedic spirit, packed with insights of character, ideological posers, and straightforward fun. Musical satisfaction kicks in immediately, with conductor John Fiore steaming into the prelude, rousingly played by the orchestra, and all the better for unfolding with, wonder of wonders, the curtain down. Each act is expertly paced, the chorus is on generous form, and thanks to detailed work from the directorial collective of Jossi Wieler, Sergio Morabito, and Anna Vibrock, the apprentices and minor master singers, led by Thomas Lehmann's anally retentive Kottner, are anything but ciphers, emerging as credible individuals with their own takes on the action. There is an unusually fraught relationship between the uptight, prudish Magdalena, Annika Schlicht, and Sachs's apprentice David, quirkily acted by Ya Chung Huang, balanced much of the time on one leg, but singing with verbal clarity and outstanding tonal beauty. Philippe Jaeckel's Beckmesser is another success, lightly flexible of voice, rarely overplaying the malicious comedy, and physically paralyzed by his complex anxieties. Albert Pessendorfer makes a sympathetic Pogner, his big bare bass conveying uncertainty as to whether he is doing the wrong thing for the right reason, and terminally heartbroken when his daughter leaves town with her lover. There's no final reconciliation. It is perhaps the director's miscalculation to portray that daughter as a sex kitten, going much too far with Sachs as well as Walter. But if Ava's crucial scenes suffer from steamy overdrive, there's nothing wrong with Heidi Stober's strong lyric singing. Vogt retains his appealing clarion tenor, and I warmed to his characterization of Walter as a slobbish chancer, saying whatever comes to mind to justify his behavior, until slugged into sense by Sachs's bourbon bottle in the Act Two finale. We'll continue this review next time. Thank you for joining us for Opera News. My name is Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.